Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 23rd of March, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. We are delighted to say we're joined today by Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Wire, who's joining us specifically to comment on yesterday's events in London.
Patrick, I'm delighted to see that you are, in fact, safe. No, I don't actually know whether you're safe. Facebook seemed to not be sure whether you were safe or not.
Yeah, I haven't registered in the database yet. just to let you know, I'm here and I'm safe. So, you know, thanks for asking, Mike. And maybe we can know on Facebook next time whether I'm safe. Have you registered, Mike and Brian? Are you guys safe?
No, we did not register with this. This is a page on Facebook, the Facebook safety check. Where anybody that is considered to be by Facebook somewhere in the region of the terrorist attack which took place yesterday gets the opportunity to say that they're safe. And if you're a friend of a person who might be living in London, you get to ask them if they're safe. So this is a fantastic step forward for us all, Pat.
Yeah, I think that's really, really wonderful. And especially, you know, it'd be great if people had that sort of concern for the people who live, the millions of people in Syria, that are under basically a terrorist onslaught on a daily basis. And this is the same country that's having to fight off Western-backed, Western-armed, Gulf-backed, Gulf-armed terrorists all over their country. They've lost thousands of people. They're losing hundreds a month, maybe thousands now. But over the course of the whole conflict in 6 years, no concern, though, but from Facebook, really, or from the loving and caring people of the West about the plight of the people of Syria who are basically being subjugated to a mostly a foreign-sponsored, foreign mercenary infestation in their country of terrorism.
Yes, indeed. Well, Patrick, look, as we look at some of the images from yesterday, maybe just ask you, because the key point here is, to my mind, again, not so much who actually carried out this particular event, but who's behind the sponsorship of the terrorist groups that the people that carry out events like this purport to support. So, you know, this is clearly Western-sponsored terrorism, indirectly perhaps, but that's what it is.
Well, in the Middle East, it is absolutely. What's important. And also, I might remind people that the number one facilitator, if you want to talk about the physical facilitation of terrorism and the proliferation of that in Syria and Iraq too, is one country, and it's a NATO country, and its name is Turkey, and that should be underlined. But yet, you don't hear this from anybody in Brussels, especially, or from anybody in London or Washington, because Turkey's an important NATO partner. And of course, NATO has access to air base facilities, military facilities, and other things in Turkey. And without Turkey, there would be no conflict in Syria, okay? Or there will only be half a conflict. And if you take away Jordan and Turkey, there would be no conflict in Syria in the last 6 years, armed conflict. Because those two countries have been key in facilitating the movement of arms, fighters, and all other illicit things and activities, and especially Turkey. And so that's really important. The number one source country that's housing extremists right now, terrorists, is Turkey. But you don't see Turkey on the travel ban of Donald Trump's travel ban. And you don't see Jordan on this travel ban, and you don't see a number of countries that are either sponsors or the sources or housing internationally recognized members of internationally designated terrorist groups. So that's really important. It's totally devoid from the conversation.
Perhaps Patrick can just add to that later on in the news. If we have time, we've got some information to do with British Defence, and Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, is boasting that alongside Britain's global power projection will come the sale of arms. And of course, it's arms from Britain and the US, which is piling into the Middle Eastern countries, helping to destabilise and create these very wars and conflicts themselves. And out of that brewing pot comes the terrorist and the extremist. So it's a double whammy with how the terrorist threat is being created.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. So, Patrick, have you got any thoughts just before we move on to some of the specifics? Have you got any thoughts about the events of yesterday and how the narrative has been building?
It reminds me a little bit of number of attacks that, you know, we saw in the news. This has been alluded to by all the commentators: the Berlin Christmas market attack and also the Nice attack, the use of a vehicle onto pedestrian areas to wipe out pedestrians and so forth. But, you know, it just strikes me as funny that, and call me a skeptic, but, you know, what kind of a terrorist attack is it to someone wanted to take on Parliament and all they've got is a knife? I find that just, you know, a little bit bizarre, to say the least. If you look at some of these other so-called terrorist attacks in Europe, you know, if the terrorist is going for maximum impact, and there's a number of things I just thought were quite strange. And I believe an armed police officer is reported to have died. I mean, they're usually wearing Kevlar. So, you know, how a police with a Kevlar vest could be a victim of a deadly knife attack. But I haven't looked at the evidence yet. So, you know, it's premature for me to speculate even. But, you know, the whole thing had this kind of staged, managed feel to it, at least from a media point of view. The media seemed to be in every single position within a very short time of the incident. And of course, everyone was speculating immediately that this was a terrorist attack or an ISIS-inspired attack. Certainly that was the line we had in the U.S. In running point on this, as usual, with CNN, because this is the sort of story which they normally stage manage for the U.S. media step by step. And so the narrative they injected immediately was ISIS inspired. And so they had all their experts on, and the timing of it then rolled in nicely into statements by people in the U.S. defense institutions talking about, you know, the need really for ramping up intervention for on the ground physical attack on Raqqa in Syria. So, you know, that it, from a terrorist point of view, sort of ridiculous as far as an attack goes. You could call it a non-event in compared to other so-called terrorist attacks or what happens in Damascus now on a daily basis. But if you look at it in the context of Western intervention, military intervention, Syria, it's actually brilliant, the timing of it. So, you know, it's I guess that's too conspiratorial to, you know, to make such a speculation. But certainly if the terrorists wanted to, you know, give the UK and the France and the US a reason to basically or promote, they've already, listen, the United States has already ramped up almost 4,000 military assets on the ground inside Syria against all international and even US law. Okay. And so, and other countries have similar assets moving into position. Okay. So it's already happening. The operation to retake Raqqa is supposed to be in April. Okay. And so this is just provides an extra nice, convenient PR push for that.
I think it provides a lot of PR. I think everything that you've said is absolutely right. And we're going to come on to a little bit of the detail of this now, Brian.
Well, we'll start off with this one. This is just the BBC report that I happened to pick up on this morning. So we've got a graphic there with labelling of the incident as it unfolded. So that's all pretty reasonable. I was just intrigued that this man appeared in the big text. And there was a video clip. Now, I will say that I haven't been able to actually listen to what this man said, but here he is, Steve Voke, and he's an eyewitness. He said he tried to stop people coming onto the bridge. So he was more than an eyewitness, really, because he started to take actions, as he says, to stop what was happening. I thought the name was interesting, and I just had a little look to see who he is. He's a creative writer. Presumably he was just up in London, happened to be on the bridge at the wrong time. But it is quite interesting who is around and who's commenting. So people may like to go and have a look at Arvon, and as an organisation, I was quite fascinated.
He works for this organisation, is that right?
He's connected with it. Yeah, it's a creative writing organisation, but it just caught my interest. But there we are. He's just a witness. This man, of course, that you've had on the screen over the last few days, Tobias Elwood, Minister for the Middle East. Well, he was there on the spot. This was a report from the Daily Mail. It said, I realised what was going on, so I headed towards it. It was a huge tragedy, it really is. I tried to stem the flow of blood and give mouth to mouth while waiting for the medics to arrive, but I think he lost too much blood. He had multiple wounds under the arm and in the back. Now, just picking up on Patrick's point, the police that I've seen in London, and certainly on these high-risk security details around Westminster, are all wearing anti-stab vests. To be stabbed under the arm, that's a possibility. But if he was stabbed in the back, do they only protect the front with these vests? I thought they were sort of front and back, but maybe we got it wrong. But here he was. He was on the spot and he got stuck in. I think Tobias Elwood is amazingly brave because he leapt into an incident where we have police, armed police, automatic weapons, who'd already shot a man. So he leaps over a fence into this incident, doesn't take any consideration of the fact that police were already shooting at people moving, and he gets involved. I'd say he's extremely brave. And then the Mail reports this in the same passage. It says, Mr. Elwood's brother, Jonathan, a 37-year-old teacher, was killed in the 2002 Bali bombing. The terror attacks carried out by Islamic extremists claimed the lives of 202 people, including 27 Britons. The MP, whose Foreign Office brief includes the Middle East, Africa and counter-terrorism. So he was absolutely the man of the moment. He's involved in the Foreign Office. He's involved in counter-terrorism. He leaps over a fence to get involved in this organisation. And praise where it's due, because in came the praise from one of his colleagues in the Foreign Office. This is Alan Duncan, MP. He says that Tobias Elwood was the right man in the right place. He has a military background and he's the sort of man who leaps into action. He's a proper get on with it guy in a crisis. I'm going to give him a stiff drink. So it's all going to be debated in the old boys club. But he's a man of action who leaps into action. As the Daily Mail report said, he leapt over a fence. I'm not sure where that would be, because most of the fences I've seen around Westminster are pretty high, but
Patrick, do you have anybody of that caliber in the United States?
Well, that's the making of a hero. That's quite a story. I don't know if that's going to be easy to top. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head, but I guess there have been a few people. Maybe Carlos Arredondo in the Boston bombings, the guy with the cowboy hat. He was our sort of version of Tobias Elwood at the moment. So, you know, these are great heroes, and these incidents, you know, make the legend of their acts and so forth. Very impressive. All I can say, very impressive.
Okay, well, we'll impress you a little bit more because the quality of Britain's police, world beating. This is BBC again. It says, Siren Police IT Projects, 15 million failure. A debacle. Now, of course, this is from some time ago, 2014. Why am I showing it? Well, because the article mentions this guy. This is the police officer, Mr. Romy, who is the spokesman in this latest terrorist incident.
He's actually the interim deputy commissioner.
Thank you.
So he's there because Cressida Dick hasn't been put in place yet.
Yes.
And if Cressida Dick had been put in place, the question is how many people would have been shot?
Well, probably Tobias Elwood would have put himself at severe risk. But let's have a look at why we're interested in this article from 2014. It was talking, quoting here, Surrey's Police and Crime Commissioner has called for one of Britain's most senior police officers to be held account for the failure of a multi-million pound computer project. This is Siren, Surrey Integrated Reporting Enterprise Network. And Mr. Hurley said, here we are, sorry, it's Rowley. Mr. Rowley is no longer employed in Surrey, but if he were, I would as PCC be considering how best to hold him to account. He's now employed by the Metropolitan Police Service. He's due to take up a new post later this month as head of specialist operations, which includes responsibility for counter-terrorism. So they move him from a failure in Surrey across to the Met to do the same job that he's just failed in with IT, and then you promote him into counter-terrorism.
Good stuff. Well, Theresa May had plenty to say yesterday. I just thought we would listen to a couple of minutes of it, and then we'll comment on it afterwards.
I have just chaired a meeting of the government's emergency committee, COBRA, following the sick and depraved terrorist attack on the streets of our capital this afternoon. The full details of exactly what happened are still emerging, but having been updated by police and security officials, I can confirm that this appalling incident began when a single attacker drove his vehicle into pedestrians walking across Westminster Bridge, killing two people and injuring many more, including three police officers. This attacker, who was armed with a knife, then ran towards Parliament, where he was confronted by the police officers who keep us and our democratic institutions safe. Tragically, one officer was killed. The terrorist was also shot dead. The United Kingdom's threat level has been set at severe for some time, and this will not change. Acting Deputy Commissioner Rowley will give a further operational update later this evening. Our thoughts and prayers go out to all who have been affected, to the victims themselves and their family and friends who waved their loved ones off but will not now be welcoming them home. For those of us who were in Parliament at the time of this attack, these events provide a particular reminder of the exceptional bravery of our police and security services who risk their lives to keep us safe. Once again today, these exceptional men and women ran towards the danger, even as they encouraged others to move the other way. On behalf of the whole country, I want to pay tribute to them and to all our emergency services for the work they have been doing to reassure the public and bring security back to the streets of our capital city.
So that was what she said last night. Now, by this morning, that had changed a little bit. She gave a, as the Express is reporting here, give a briefing to the Commons. She said, yesterday, an act of terrorism tried to silence our democracy, but today we meet as normal, as generations have done before us, and as future generations will continue to do. And she went on to say that basically that the perpetrator's identity is known to the police and MI5, but when operational conditions allow, considerations allow, he's going to be publicly identified. She said that what she can confirm is that the man was British born and that some years ago he was once investigated in relation to concerns about violent extremism. She said that he was a peripheral figure. She said that the case involving him is historic. He's not part of the current intelligence picture. So that's what she had to say. I have to say that her sincerity during that briefing outside Number 10 was
nauseating, is the word.
I thought it was. It would have put Tony Blair to shame. It possibly even outdid him. But nonetheless, what we're talking about here, Patrick, is someone that they're now saying was known to MI5, although sometime in the past. But where does that leave us? Are we now being presented with the idea that we've got to be scared of anybody that, you know, the police may have known 20 years ago, perhaps?
Well, this is the standard MO of the known wolf. So we saw exactly the same thing in almost every single, most of the attacks in Germany, certainly the one with the Christmas market attack, the attack in Nice, that was a known wolf as well. Charlie Hebdo, the Kouachi brothers, not only known wolves, but were being tailed by security services continuously for a long period of time. And their accomplice as well was also very much known and had a criminal record and links to extremism, etc. And so we see this time and time again on almost all of these cases, this profile of the known wolf. So at what point is this somebody, maybe in the media perhaps, might look into this and say, wow, this is a bit strange. You know, this is just beyond a trend. How are all these people on the radar? And, you know, you hear this bandied about endlessly on the mainstream media in the concern about young British jihadists going to fight in Syria, the 800 or so British fighters fighting with ISIS and al-Nusra in Syria. So if they know there's 800 of them, this is my question to everybody. If they know there's 800 of them from Britain, and I think that's a very low number, by the way, extremely conservative, then if they have that number, then they must know the names. And if they know the names, how are these people allowed to go back and forth? And we've said this on your show. We've said this years ago, actually. And Vanessa Bealey spoke in King's Cross, I believe, a couple of weeks ago. And there were people in the audience shouting. There were people throwing stink bombs outside. There were people bust in who have known links to extremists who are running around in Britain and, you know, are guests. They're from Syria, Syrian activists now. Somehow they're nesting in Britain. They're having funerals of dead fighters who come back, you know, and their funeral processions around the country, you know, in some of these communities of these known extremists, ISIS fighters, al-Nusra fighters. So what I'm saying is this is a very dangerous game, I believe, this whole covert dirty war in Syria and using these assets and then giving political legitimacy to some of these organizations that are blatantly promoting the most violent brand of extremism imaginable on the planet and what's going on in Syria. And that is being done right under the nose of this government who is concerned about terrorism. But yet people should ask the question, what is this government? What is the U.S. government? What is the French government? What roles do these governments have, even the German government, in facilitating this terrorism that is spreading like a cancer? Okay.
Patrick, I'm going to go further and I'm going to go back to the point earlier and say it's sponsored because, you know, who created Al-Qaeda in the first place? Al-Qaeda came out of the Mujahideen, sponsored by the CIA and Western governments. And we have the situation, as you say, where we seem to be building an excuse to take action in the Middle East. So we're training people in the Middle East, not directly, but by proxy, who are then coming back or are being encouraged or at least people are being encouraged to admire what's going on in the Middle East and take action in the UK. That then is being used to drive what's going on in the Middle East. And so it becomes a continuous circle of activity. And as you say, these people are not being challenged in this country. In fact, some people are saying that, for example, the PREVENT strategy is encouraging this type of extremism, the growth of this extremism in this country. And so when you look at all these things that are going on, it may be circumstantial, but it is certainly building a picture which suggests strongly that the Western governments, Britain in particular, is supporting this kind of activity, this kind of extremism in order to drive forward with their political agenda.
In not just a political agenda, this country, in the United States, Britain, many of the NATO member states, especially U.S. and Britain, they have a vested interest, billions of dollars by now, in regime change in Syria. And the chief party they've been backing to achieve that regime change or destabilization in Syria has been the religious extremists, al-Nusra, Nur al-Din Zinki, Ahrar al-Sham, and these groups. These are the same as ISIS. This is what the British press refuses to acknowledge. This is what the U.S. press refuses to acknowledge. Okay, there is no difference. To the average Syrian, there's no difference between ISIS and al-Nusra. They're all religious, extremist, violent maniacs, okay? They might fly a different flag and have a different brand, but to the sort of, I don't know, to use a kind word, to the naive Western media, they seem to want to distinguish and separate all these brands very neatly on the table, and so to talk of them in different ways. I met a 19-year-old student in Britain who told me two of his friends just got killed in a Russian airstrike while they're fighting for al-Nusra in Syria, and they're from some small town in England. One of them, I don't think, was even Muslim. So I have to ask, what's going on here? You know, what's the scale of this problem? How is this able to happen for 5 years straight?
Well, perhaps this gives us a little bit of a clue. This was Newsnight last night talking about the events in London yesterday. And Simon Jenkins, the journalist, the columnist for the Evening Standard and the Guardian, was on. Evan Davis was asking the questions, and Evan Davis said to him, you know, four innocent people were tragically killed. On the other hand, you don't want to give them, the terrorists, the publicity and the sense of momentum, you know, that would create. And Simon Jenkins made it absolutely clear. He said, well, that's what you've just done. He said the BBC today has made the choice. They have opted, if I may say so, with the terrorist. Evan Davis sort of defended himself a little bit by saying, well, you can't just ignore what had happened. And Jenkins said, no one suggests you ignore it. That's what you always say when someone like me protests about how much publicity you give these incidents. You have a choice of prominence, and the prominence you've given is aiding and abetting terrorism. It's absolutely clear. He went on to make the point that, you know, when the IRA was active in on the British mainland, these were considered criminal events. And he said what happened yesterday was no more than a criminal event. It should be considered a criminal event. He doesn't actually say, you know, we don't actually know whether this was a real terrorist or somebody that was just mentally unstable. He said in no way was he decrying anybody that was killed or injured in the thing. But the point here is that the BBC, through the style of coverage that they chose to present, was promoting this extremism. And when you've got an organisation with the budget of the BBC promoting extremism in this way, then perhaps we're seeing the results of that.
But Simon Jenkins is spot on. Absolutely. Okay, if you look at a few days ago in France, the incident that took place at the airport, it's just come out recently. This guy had so many drugs in his system. I think maybe everything from cannabis to cocaine. So, you know, at what point, if someone's drugged up and out of their head, at what point does it become exactly that, a criminal act, a drug-induced, intoxicated, violent act? And then, but it immediately it's branded as terrorist-related by the media. It's in a knee-jerk reaction. In fact, the Met Police put out a statement on their Twitter account saying that we're treating this as a terrorist incident until proven otherwise. So, you know, what exactly is this way of thinking? What is this logic? Is this the new think? Is this the new groupthink right now? You know, we are in 1984. We're in George Orwell's 1984, because if we weren't in 1984, we'd step back and say, you know, let's actually have an investigation. Let's find out what happened here. Let's find out who the perp is. Let's find out what their motive is. Let's look at the evidence. But you have this in reverse now. It's this festival of the glorification of international political terrorism the media engages in right from the get-go. And also, I just want to add before I'll let you come back, but CNN, their big correspondent, Clarissa Ward, who's been over with the moderate terrorists in Syria, she made a statement on CNN during the broadcast yesterday. She said that people should do the responsible thing if they have any videos or photos, not to put them in public, but to give them to the police. That was said on CNN on the live broadcast covering the London terrorist attacks. And we have a recording of it, and we'll play it probably on our show on the weekend. But just to tell you, that's the sort of messaging that's also being pumped through the media. Now, what exactly is that? That you can't post things on social media if you take pictures of an event like that? You have to hold it and do the right thing and give it to the police first? Because if it's evidence, it's evidence. And it doesn't matter if it's public or if the police see it, because it happened. So why should it be kept from public view?
Is this a concern on behalf of CNN that if we look at past similar events, there's been a lot of analysis done on the internet using images which were not handed to the police first?
Absolutely. Basically, most major events since camera phones, you know, became mainstream, that would be the case. That's always the case, actually, now.
But of course, it's not just the media. I'm not really quite sure exactly when this happened, but sometime before the Paris attack, the original Paris attacks or something, we suddenly had monuments isn't the right word, but sort of public spaces in cities around the world suddenly getting new lighting systems so that no matter what event happens, we can light buildings and monuments up with the appropriate colors in order to show solidarity. And so here we've got from Birmingham to Tel Aviv, we've got Union Jacks in red, white, and blue, so that it's pushed into the minds of everybody, no matter what country you're in, no matter the scale of the event, everybody gets some kind of
reminder
of it. It's
mind control. I think it's called. It's reframing. It's propaganda, but it's. We're seeing it's on a global basis, which makes it particularly interesting.
Well, I just
go ahead. Just quickly, this is the instant feedback after all of these events. Everyone wants to. People generally want to show their good feelings for the country that's been a victim of a terrorist attack. So everyone will change their Facebook profile and overlay a flag of France or Britain over their picture on Facebook. That's one thing that people have been conditioned to do, I think, a lot of people. And then also lighting up buildings. So it's become this ritual. So there is a ritualistic aspect to it. And this is the sort of the feedback that the public expects after these events, that sort of these things will take place and these shows of concern and group solidarity and so forth will take place. But, that's all well and good. And, taking nothing away from anybody who was hurt, had died or injured or any of their families or anything. But we have to look at the actual incident. And it must be investigated and looked at for what is really there first. So often after these events, down the line, weeks, months, maybe years after, we find out that it actually wasn't what it was portrayed to be immediately by the media. So then what happens, all that political capital and all that social capital was expended from the event, even though maybe it wasn't exactly as it was portrayed when it first happened. That's the sort of repeated incident crime. I think that's a crime on itself, which happens over and over with all of these high profile so-called terrorist attacks. And by the way, many of the ones in Germany over the last year in 2016 were not terrorist related at all, but they were reported as ISIS inspired attacks. And so that created a political narrative in Germany and the EU and so forth and so on, and reverberated globally because of that. But they weren't all ISIS-inspired attacks. In fact, I would say that it's possible that none of them were ISIS-inspired attacks. If you really drill down and look at the evidence, who was involved, what their affiliations were, what actually happened.
Yeah. Well, let's just look at a mind game, because I think this is probably the most extreme example of it I saw in the last 24 hours. This is Brendan Cox, the husband of Joe Cox. And the headline says, whether this is an accurate direct quote or not, I'm not sure, but the headline says, Westminster attacker represents British Muslims no more than Joe Cox's killer represents Yorkshire. And this is a very well-constructed headline, because what will appear in people's minds or what will register subconsciously is the first section of it, Westminster attacker represents British Muslims. The no more is quite passive in it's quite a passive phrase, and so it will not register with people. The first bit is what is going to register with people, and this is clearly designed, in my view, to sort of create angst between communities.
I would agree with that, Mike, and we're increasingly seeing this very sophisticated language. We could say we're seeing huge amounts of NLP within the written language of newspapers. And of course, we know people are trained at doing this. So propaganda, but presented in a very dangerous way.
Now, Patrick, we're going to talk about your interview with Mr. McAfee last night in a second, but on the sort of snooping and wiretapping subject, this is Max Hastings saying, and this is one of the more extreme responses that I've seen, if our phones have to be tapped by the spooks, so be it. We must back intelligence agencies in fight against terror. This is kind of pretty dangerous rhetoric, Patrick, and I think we've seen this in something not quite as bad as this, perhaps, but we've seen similar calls in other mainstream newspapers. We must give away all our liberties in order to gain protection.
Yeah, well, that's where we're at right now as a society, is in the West anyway, is that there's an expectation, and we spoke about this last night with John McAfee, this founder of McAfee Antivirus, CEO of MGT Capital Investment, and you know, pioneer in cybersecurity, and also a great pundit as well. And you know, we've spoke about the fact that we've reached a point in society where we're expected that, you know, we're happy, or we've somehow said it's okay, or the government says, actually no, we've reached a point where the government says, we need all of your data, we need every single piece of communication, we need every single bit of digital telecommunications data attached to you. And the reason we need that is because we are at war, and this is an issue of national security. That's where we are right now as a society. So they have everything. So in other words, there's no need for a warrant anymore. Why do you need a warrant to go and wiretap when you're already being wiretapped? So my point is, and the point of John McAfee last night on this great interview, which I encourage people to go listen to, it was epic. The point is that, you know, if someone wants to get any information, be it a telephone call, an email, a comment you made, or, you know, or whatever, a photo or anything they want, it's already sitting there. Somebody somewhere has got it on a server and can call it up in a matter of seconds. So there's no need for a warrant. It's already been collected. So, you know, we've reached a point in the advancement of technology where the laws and the sort of the legal structure, which we had before, has been completely, the government has done a total runaround of the law itself through technology. And the legal system is just sitting there twiddling their thumbs as if this didn't happen. That's where we're at right now with the Trump Tower controversy and the wiretapping in America. They don't need a FISA warrant in America to wiretap Donald Trump or anybody else because it's already being done.
Yep.
So all they have to do is open up X key score or whatever the software, the mining program is, type in these a few data fields, and boom, there it is. You know, and someone can look at it. There's people who will look at it, who can look at it for a number of reasons under the auspices of national security. And keep it on a server forever, because storing data is cheap. Storing things in the cloud is cheap. So, you know, it'll just be there forever. We have to ask ourselves, you know, what sort of society have we built here? Because we're here. We're in 1984 right now. If Ed Snowden and the CIA Vault 7 leaks with WikiLeaks, or Julian Assange is illustrated this many times, we're in 1984. It's now. This is it. And it's not next generation, which John McAfee said last night as well. He said, we're here now. So we have to do something about it now and not wait another generation, because if we wait, it's going to be too late. We can't marinate another generation in digital surveillance and a zero rights society with no expectation of any privacy at all. As a society, we will implode without some level of privacy for citizens.
Yep.
It will happen.
Yes, okay, and we can hear that that interview on 21stcenturywire.com.
Yes.
Yes,
right, yeah, okay. It's up there, and 21wire.tv as well.
Okay, thank you, Pat. Okay, well, tonight, well, it's not the Monday live program schedule because this is Thursday. So tonight Ian Crane will be in the studio, Humanity versus Insanity, at 7:30. And he says, whilst the lone wolf attack occurs in London, the UK government and UK arms industry continue to be at the forefront of the global hegemony. Let's take a long look in the mirror. And for Fracking Nightmare at 9 o'clock, he's calling this the coming water wars, courtesy of the UK mother frackers. He says, as the UK fracking companies seek to make 2017 the year they get their bits in the ground, the anti-fracking campaign moves from the council chamber and the courts to boots on the ground. The agenda to save the UK's water supply is about to go to a whole new level. So join us for that at 9 o'clock this evening. Now, I want to say a well done to William Kelly, and thank you very much for this. This is absolutely fantastic. These are mobile video machines. They're showing the live stream of UK Column and any other programmes that are on. And as you can see, they can take it wherever they want. They need to take it to protests, into town centres, city centres. This is going to be fantastic. I think that's a brilliant initiative, and I'd say thank you very much for that.
And it's good to see the police watching it.
Absolutely.
Very important for their education. Yeah, so well done to those police officers.
I believe they stuck around for quite a while. So, and a reminder that tonight people are calling for a tweet storm in support of Melanie Shaw. The hashtag is Free Melanie Shaw. Melanie Shaw still in prison receiving inhumane treatment at HM Prison, Foston Hall. I believe still in solitary confinement.
As far as we know, but of course her communication's heavily censored, so people that have been most instrumental in trying to help her are not able to communicate with her at the moment.
Okay, so Patrick, you and Vanessa are off to the Middle East in the not-too-distant future.
Yes, so you know we're hoping to, we put out the word for an appeal for an investigative fund. We're planning to report from on the ground in the Middle East in multiple countries this spring, hopefully as early as April, but definitely in May. And so, you know, we need as much help and support as possible for that. So, you know, we're putting an appeal out. If anybody wants to sponsor this, help us on any level at all, as much or as little as they want, it's greatly appreciated. We already have a number of ongoing investigations, as you know of, with stories in that region, especially in Syria, which you know, we'll be able to follow up, and also some new stories as well. So, you know, we intend to make a big impact in terms of our journalism with that journey, and so we need our listeners and our readers' support to make that happen. So we really appreciate it for anybody that can help.
Okay, thank you. That's 21stcenturywire.com for that. And Brian, Nottingham?
Well, Nottingham, we are very keen for as many people as possible to come to the British Constitution event in Nottingham on the 22nd of April. A vast hall, a very beautiful hall. And the aim of this is not set piece talks. This is aimed for discussion groups on a number of different subjects. You can visit the BritishConstitutionGroup.com to have a look at those discussion groups. But this is getting people to share information on the ground, what you're doing, how it's working, what you think should be done. This is good people coming together to stop what we're seeing happening in this country and indeed worldwide. So if you are somebody who hasn't gone to one of these events before, please come along. But if you are active on the ground, we'd like to see you there in order to make friends and build a proper movement to, quote, reassert the rule of law.
Okay, Patrick, the West's peaceful revolution narrative in Syria was a lie from the beginning.
Yeah, this is a story that I published up 21stcenturywire.com. This is something that a lot of people are probably already familiar with, especially your audience and my audience as well. But I just want to reiterate this. There's a number of evidential points in this article. This is a great tool, this article. And there's a video by Kevork Almazian, who's a brilliant analyst based in Germany. He's Syrian, and he has put a video in there detailing a lot of the evidence that the so-called revolution was not a revolution in Syria from the beginning. It was a violent uprising, and later we found out that it's a Western and Gulf-backed violent uprising. Very violent, killing people, and police especially, who were trying to be there to, you know, protect the public in many cases, were killed in cold blood by the peaceful protesters. And so point after point, and then also evidence the amount of things that we found in terms of the United States as far back as 1986, the plan to basically topple society in Syria was a U.S. directive from as early back that we can find as the mid-1980s, and especially a number of points came out since 2002. So it's a complete lie to say that this was some sort of part of the Arab Spring. It absolutely wasn't. The evidence is in that article, and it's elsewhere too on the web for anybody who wants to go look at it. But yet the British media, the U.S. media, the European media are still spinning this fiction that it was this somehow this peaceful, you know, these poor people who want a progressive liberal democracy in the Middle East being subjugated by the brutal dictator Bashar al-Assad, etc. That's just mythology that's been propagated now for 6 years, basically. And so that article helps. It's a great tool that people can share to help show people what the real story is.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for that.
Well, with an eye on the clock, we just end by giving people really a recap at British defence policy. We were sent this document, Ministry of Defence Annual Report and Accounts 2015-16, easily available on the internet. Encourage people to have a look. Of course, our very own Mr. Fallon there, and of what's he talking about? Over the last year, threats to international security grew, spreading terror across the world.
Russia.
Russia, belligerence, and mass migration. But the UK's response was unequivocal. We continue to deter and confront aggression wherever we found it. Well, we bring in the end here. He says, finally, since national security and economic security are two sides of the same coin, exports will become integral to our agenda. We'll be working closely with UK trade investment to promote defence exports. What is he talking about? He's talking about arms, which, of course, are going to be pumped everywhere in the world because that's good for our economy, Mike.
Yes.
And I do this one very quickly. The other thing that comes out in this document, under his signature, which I've been delighted to put on screen, the UK increased its contribution to EU common security and defence policy during 2015. It then details all the operations. So absolute lie that Brexit is taking place. What this man is talking about is, of course, that we're building deeper collaboration with the French, we're building deeper collaboration with the Germans, we're building the collaboration with the European Union. Brexit is simply a lie.
Just very briefly, Patrick, but of course what he's talking about here as well is the fact that we're going to litter the planet with our weapons. Saudi Arabia undoubtedly will be a destination, and of course we can't forget Yemen.
Mm-hmm. No, that's record-breaking arms sales from the U.S. and the U.K. to Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war in Yemen in March 2015. So I think we're coming. It's 2 years now, 2 year anniversary of that war. So you know those are the big winners in those conflicts. So dead Yemenis equals profits for certain defense contractors. You know what else can we say? But you know we have this issue. It's a much bigger issue in America. And by the way, if the American defense industry is planning to steamroll Europe with its products, by the way, because America has economies of scale, Britain does not, and European defense manufacturers don't. So, you know, invariably, America will get the biggest piece of the pie and the profits for all of these initiatives that you're talking about.
Well, in fact, we believe that BAE Systems will end up probably being owned by Lockheed Martin in the not too distant future.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you know, Brian and Mike, you know, do you know what they call, you know, what the defense contractors, the inside joke in America is BAE, British and expensive, is the sort of inside joke that they have, some of the big players here. So, you know, it's not regarded as on equal footing in America by even by some of the insiders in the defense industry here. So it's, you know, it's, Can it compete with Boeing and Lockheed Martin on that level? Maybe, maybe not. But eventually it'll amalgamate and be joined and merged with the U.S. companies. And there'll be no U.S. or British companies. They'll just be corporations. I think that's probably pretty much where we're at anyway.
That's exactly what we are seeing.
Okay,
well, Patrick, thank you very much for joining us. You are entitled to coffee and breakfast now, because I believe it's still very early there in the States.
No, tea.
It's tea. Well, good. That's obviously your time in UK done that. Thanks for joining us. And for everybody else, Michael will be back tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Mike will be back at 1 o'clock.
With David Scott.
With David Scott. Thank you. See you then. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.